to bring the House Committee on Environment and Energy to order. Thank you all for being here today. The agenda has us looking at Cleaner Air Oregon first. We'll have a public hearing. For folks that may be following the rest of our agenda, I'll just let you know that we're going to be doing some form of work and or public hearing on several of the bills, but I'll be carrying over almost all of them until Wednesday. And so one of them, I think that I'll dispense with at the moment so that if you're here for it, you can do other important things, is I'm carrying over House Bill 4016 to our agenda on Wednesday, February 14th. We're doing a dance with the Senate Committee on Natural Resources and Environment. We're doing Cleaner Air Oregon updates here in the early part of our hearing, while the Senate does a work session on the Clean Energy Jobs Bill, and then we're essentially switching our folks from room to room. We'll stay here. The Clean Energy Jobs folks will come here, and if Cleaner Air Oregon folks will be presenting over in the Senate. We will be doing a little bit of work, colleagues, on House Bill on Clean Energy, on the Clean Energy Jobs Bill, House Bill 4001. And then I'm going to try to fit in Representative Barnhart's bill, House Bill 4022, and do the public hearing and work session quickly and move it out of the committee today if the votes are there to do it. So we'll fit it in right after Cleaner Air Oregon. So at this time, I will open a public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 4002, and invite Director Whitman and Lillian Shirley up to the dais, please. And folks, I'm allocating between 30 and 40 minutes for this. We have some comments by Director Whitman and Ms. Shirley, and then I'll ask for questions from the committee, and then we'll have public testimony after that. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Helm, members of the committee. For the record, Richard Whitman, the Director of the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality, here to testify on House Bill 4002. In April of 2016, Governor Brown directed the Department of Environmental Quality and the Oregon Health Authority to put together an industrial air toxics program for Oregon. Oregon has regulated facilities primarily on the basis of federal law, which involves what are called technology-based limits based on what's feasible rather than based on what is health protective for Oregonians. While this approach has succeeded in reducing air pollution on an area-wide basis, pretty much across Oregon, we have not focused attention on the localized health effects of particular sources. Approximately 30 other states in the U.S. have adopted health-based air toxics programs. Many of those were adopted in the 1980s before amendments to the Federal Clean Air Act. This includes all of Oregon's neighboring states, including the state of Idaho. For the past 18 months, DEQ and the Oregon Health Authority have worked with a Rules Advisory Committee to develop a health-based program to control industrial air toxics. Last fall, DEQ published draft rules for this program, known as Cleaner Air Oregon. The final decision on these rules will be made by the Environmental Quality Commission, and that's expected to be in July of this year. The development of this program represents an unprecedented level of public engagement. The agency started by conducting a listening tour around the state to understand community and business concerns related to air toxics. The agencies convened a panel of nationally recognized experts to advise on the potential program structure. And then The agencies established a Rules Advisory Committee with 24 members comprised of small and large businesses, local governments, citizens, and public health advocates. The Rules Advisory Committee met 9 times over the course of a year. Most recently, the agencies have produced draft rules for a 90-day public comment period that included 9 more public hearings around the state, and we've received more than 700 comments on the draft rules. The agencies also have met repeatedly with individual companies and with community representatives and business representatives to hear their concerns and hopes for the program. We strongly believe that Oregon can have an industrial air toxics program that protects public health and creates certainty for our businesses and communities. The program we're developing is consistent with the 30 other programs that other states have operated successfully for decades. So with that, let me talk briefly about House Bill 4002. House Bill 4002 authorizes and directs the Environmental Quality Commission to establish a set of fees that are sufficient to implement this industrial air toxics program. That includes a base fee for all facilities that currently have an air permit from Oregon DEQ, as well as a fee that's based on the complexity of the work with the particular business. These fees range from a low of $71 for a small business to a little over $1,000 for a medium-sized facility. And for our larger facilities, including those that are in what's called a Title V federal air program, the fees can go into the thousands of dollars and are based in part on the amount of emissions from a particular facility. These fees will pay for the staff necessary to operate this program. That includes 8 positions at the Department of Environmental Quality, as well as 2 positions at the Oregon Health Authority. The DEQ positions include permit writers, air quality, an air quality modeler, to provide technical assistance to businesses who are going through the program, and a program coordinator to serve as a liaison with regulated businesses and community groups. And the Oregon Health Authority positions include a toxicologist to provide technical expertise related to risk assessment, as well as a public health educator responsible for community engagement and risk communication. So with that, I'm going to close. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have about this proposed legislation. And I will say, I have with me today Lillian Shirley, the public health director for the state of Oregon.
For the record.
For the record.
Shirley, did you have any prepared comments or just here for questions?
No, I'm here basically for questions, and I think Director Whitman identified basically how we intend to implement this and what the staffing needs are for that, and we are in agreement.
Okay. Committee members, questions for our panel? Representative Risch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and we'll just start with that. How many new positions at DEQ will be needed to implement said program?
Chair Helm, Vice Chair Reschke, this bill proposes funding to pay for 8 new positions at the Department of Environmental Quality.
Other questions? Representative Findley.
I have a 2-part question. Thank you, Chairman Helms. So 8 positions at DEQ, 2 positions with OHA as well. Line 7 of the bill reads, it should include a fee reasonably calculated to cover the direct and indirect cost of DEQ and the environmental quality condition. What decided that's a reasonable fee? I don't know how you got where you got to, so I was trying to figure that one out, sir.
Chair Helm and Representative Findley, the analysis is based on a fiscal impact for this bill that shows the number of positions that would be required to do the evaluation and prioritization of businesses to decide which businesses will be looked at first in terms of emissions and health risk, and then to work with those specific businesses as they work through the program.
I have one follow-up question.
Follow-up.
Some of the federal DEQ standards on emissions for some facilities, and I'm thinking about a facility in Far Eastern Oregon, the Lime facility,
yes.
set standards that were unobtainable. The technology was not there to reach those standards. So the company's in instant violation, and they can't fix it because the standards are unobtainable. Would they be in direct violation in this program as well?
Chair Helm, Representative Finley, appreciate the question. The way the program is being designed, and again, these rules have not been adopted yet, so this is what's proposed, is the rules would require companies that are over certain health risk levels to install what is called toxic best available control technology. That is an analysis, and that will require an analysis of what the best emissions controls are for each industry. So in your case, the cement, I think you're referring to the cement facility in Durkee, there would be an analysis of what other cement facilities around the country have done to control their toxic emissions, and that is what that facility would be required to do. So to be clear, that business would not be required to curtail production or shut down. That what they would be required to do is to install that technology.
Any further questions? Representative Broxbeck.
Thank you. And thank you, Director. And we all know, of course, the Secretary of State's audits and how understaffed your department is. And so you mentioned that there was 8 positions that will be created to fulfill this. And of course, the catalyst for this was Bullseye Glass, of course. If you had those positions in place at the DEQ prior to the Bullseye Glass incident, would you have been able to use the existing laws that are meant to protect the citizens to stop the emissions that were occurring?
Chair Helm, Representative Brock Smith, having additional staff in and of itself would not have changed the situation that occurred with Bullseye Glass. It was going through the monitoring work that the agency did with the U.S. Forest Service that identified that particular source. And so it's really a combination of both having the staff to do that sort of work, in this case working also with the Forest Service, as well as the technology to identify particular sources of particular air toxics. And as you may know, the use of MOS to identify particular locations is really cutting edge. It's the first time that technology had been used in the United States for that purpose.
Thank you.
Representative Barnhart and then Representative Power.
Thank you. I don't know much about the fee system that we use in Oregon, but I do know that every once in a while we get a bill in the legislature to approve fees that have already been adopted. Mm-hmm. Do these fees that are described in this bill come under that sort of procedure?
Chair Helm, Representative Barnhart, no, they do not. There is a limitation in this bill for the amount of fees that could be set up in rule for this particular biennium, I believe, of $2 million. Yeah. And then in subsequent biennia, it would be part of the regular budget process.
So if I could follow up. So when you say part of the regular budget process, this would be under the jurisdiction of the Ways and Means process, and they would hold hearings and make determinations about what the budget would be.
Chair Helm, Representative Barnhart, that's correct. I will say that the fees, once they are established, would become part of our base budget. Right. So the main focus of Ways and Means would be if we were proposing any sort of fee increase.
Right. Yeah, the point, Mr. Chair, is to point out that there is oversight over the maximum amount they can charge. And as described, it has to do with the budget. And I appreciate that information. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Powell.
Thank you. Representative Brocksmith actually started to get at my question, but I wanted to put it a little bit more squarely on the record. Since earlier this year, the Secretary of State's audit revealed that many of the air quality permits are significantly behind schedule and being renewed. Mm-hmm. And I think I've seen some criticism online about why DEQ would be standing up a new program when they are behind on the existing ones. So I wanted to give you a chance to address that with us.
Thank you, Chair Helm and Vice Chair Power. I just appeared before the Joint Legislative Audit Committee and spent some time talking with them about this issue as well. And it's a fair question that I think would occur to most people if DEQ is struggling with its core air permitting program, why should the legislature be giving them another program to operate? And the reason, very directly, is if you go to the Secretary of State's audit and read it carefully, you will see that one of the key causes of the permit backlog is the fact that our permitting staff are being pulled off on an ad hoc basis dealing with controversies in particular communities. And that I think many of you are familiar with, that have occurred really across the state. And without having a set of clear rules of the road for what the expectations are for industrial air toxics, we're dealing in an ad hoc situation with community concerns and with businesses, and businesses don't have the certainty either that they need to make investment decisions and operate. So this is leading to, in my mind, somewhat unnecessary costs both for the state and for the business community and for folks in our communities. It's, I think, causing uncertainty and fear without really knowing what levels of air toxics are acceptable for our communities. And so that's why, somewhat counterintuitively, having this program, we believe, actually will allow our permit writers to go back to doing what they were hired to do, which is write permits.
Thank you.
Final question for Representative Reschke, Vice Chair Reschke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I forgot to say welcome.
Thank you.
you did your, I guess, air toxic tour, right? And I'm just wondering what industry's response was to that as you were rolling out or describing the program to them. Were they saying, this is needed, this is punitive, you're wonderful, you're crazy? What was their response?
Chair Helm, Vice Chair Reschke, you know, I think it's fair to say on the whole, the business community has a significant level of concern about this program. I don't want to make you think otherwise. We received quite a few postcards, for instance, in our public comment period from businesses that are concerned about the effects on business. And I think, you know, my response to those businesses is we are working very hard to put in place a program that is comparable to programs that have existed for decades in other states, again, including Washington and Idaho, that have been operated successfully without having significant adverse effects on the business community. So we want to hear those concerns and what the concerns are specifically. And if we're missing something or not understanding something, we want to know that and be able to figure out what the solution is. I think my personal impression is there is still concern in the business community, but I think as the business community is starting to understand the program a little bit better, and we're working to clear up some areas of ambiguity, the level of concern appears to be coming down a little bit.
Follow up.
Thank you. Did you notice any difference between urban Oregon and rural Oregon in those concerns?
Chair Helm, Vice Chair Reschke, you know, businesses in both urban areas and rural areas are concerned about this program. The concerns are a little bit different, and mainly the concerns are coming from businesses that located a long time ago, perhaps next to a residential area, and through, you know, in some ways no fault of their own, things have grown up around them that have in some ways created some of the risks that we're concerned with. So there is a longer term issue here about land use and trying to think proactively about where we put some of these facilities. And that's a discussion that we welcome. We're not going to solve that one overnight, but it is something I think we should be paying more attention to.
Representative Brock Smith, we have the last question.
Thank you, and I will say thank you, Mr. Chair. And I will say that I have concerns with those facilities down in my 6% below mean zero pre-recession unemployment areas in my district. My question is, it's two-part, Director. EPA regulations, of course, are we have EPA standards that regulate the air quality for to protect residents, not just in Oregon, but across the country. A, the first question is, do you think that they're adequate? And B, how does this program, how is it greater than the EPA regulations that exist? That's my two-part question.
Chair Helm and Representative Brock Smith, the short answer to your question is no, I don't think the federal regulations are adequate. This program is designed to fill some of the gaps in our current federal air quality laws, which focus really more on area-wide air quality, what the overall air quality is, rather than looking at air quality in a particular community near a particular industrial facility. And that's why we have 30 other states that have this type of program. In terms of what or how this program would fill that gap, it would look to identify the highest risk facilities in Oregon and really work with those businesses to, first of all, and importantly, figure out what the actual risk is so that we're not creating confusion. But secondly, if there is real risk there, to work with the business to reduce that risk over time. And that can be done in any number of ways, not just installing expensive emission controls. There are often other ways to reduce those risks. We talk routinely with businesses where there's some concern about their emissions and potential health effects. And the one thing that I've observed since taking this job is that those businesses, when we go in and have a conversation with them, they want the same thing we do. They're not interested in harming their neighbors, and they will generally take responsible steps to address and reduce risk if risk exists. So this is a way of simply doing that more methodically, more consciously, and in a way that protects communities, but also does not drive businesses out of those communities.
Good. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
Giving us this update. We appreciate it. I'm going to move to public testimony now and invite Alan Sprope, Mary Pivato, and Erica Mosen up. Hope I pronounced everybody's name correctly.
Hi, my name is Erica Moseson, and I'm a lung and ICU doctor. And I thank you for the opportunity to speak here today. It's interesting to see a different approach. So I, taking care of my patients who have lung disease, I'm constantly telling them if you inhale something, it's like injecting it in your veins. So why does anyone do drugs? Why does anyone inhale pot or smoke cigarettes? It's because when you take that puff, within a heartbeat, it's in your brain, it's in your entire body, it's in all your organs. And so if you don't want to inject anything into your veins or the veins of your children, you certainly don't want to allow them to be breathing it in to their lungs. And I think there's this other aspect that I haven't, I'm not sure is always appreciated, because I live with my patients every day seeing the devastating economic effects on an individual family when someone starts to suffer from some of these chronic diseases that are caused by long-term air pollution, or God forbid, one of the leukemias or any of the devastating effects from an inhaled heavy metal. When you develop COPD or asthma and you're stuck at home and you can't work, or God forbid, your kid has to stay home sick and then that you can't work. We've measured the effects of, you know, things like cigarette smoking, which is very analogous to other types of air pollution entering our children's bodies. And we know there's a massive hit to business, to private employers, in terms of missed sick days, increased healthcare premiums for their employees. And then that falls on all of us, right? Because when you're sick and you can't work and you can't provide for your family, you end up on our Care Oregon plan, which again, increases healthcare expenditures for our state. So it's been really interesting coming down, trying to advocate for the importance of clean air, whether it's, you know, from cigarette smoke, diesel pollution, heavy metals being burned next door, whatever it is, it all has massive healthcare costs, and we all pay for that. Whether it's in our increased personal premiums, whether it's all the extra inhalers we have to buy, which is $11,000 a year for a 2-inhaler regimen, and that's not even including the doctor's visits and all these sorts of things. So I think sometimes I'll hear people say things like, well, we can't clean up the air right now, we have to solve healthcare costs, or we have to solve the Care Oregon budget shortfall, and it's the same conversation. And even just kind of bringing it to the personal level, is a golden rule, I guess. If you wouldn't want your kid to breathe it, you shouldn't want someone else's kid to breathe it. And I agree. I don't think, I've got friends who are small business owners, and you know, and I don't think they want to make anyone sick. And for the ones that aren't polluting, they shouldn't have to pay for the ones that are raising healthcare costs. And I have a feeling that the ones who are want to also help pay their fair share. And I want to touch a little bit on the cost of anxiety, which I think was mentioned about the fact that our DEQ employees have to be running around the state trying to put out people's concerns about clean air and can't do their job. Those are healthcare costs too. I had plenty of patients running into my office worried that their lung disease was now worse because of what had been going on in the air. And I didn't really have a way to reassure them. I could say that, yeah, our air is not that great, but I couldn't say, okay, well, where you live, based on this air quality monitor, and they'd say, well, there's someone doing something in the, you know, the mechanic shop across the street, is that affecting me? And I could just say, I don't know, because there's no air quality monitor. So even just doing a robust system where we fund good quality monitors, where we can actually answer the question and target resources appropriately, would just also be a much more efficient use, I think, of our dollars, which is ultimately our healthcare dollars.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Mary Pivato. I'm the president of Neighbors for Clean Air, and I'm here to, and I thank you for the opportunity to be here today to testify in support of House Bill 4002. Neighbors for Clean Air is an organization which represents frontline communities impacted by air pollution. HB 4002 is the final component of the nearly two-year rulemaking process of Cleaner Air Oregon. This is, some of you may recall, began when revelations of high concentrations of industrial metals were found in moss samples, spurred the mass mobilization to address the legacy of public health risk after decades of neglect by regulators in Oregon's air permit program. While the mass mobilization was unique, these last 2 years, I will say that the level of community anxiety is not. Something that I knew firsthand when I discovered that my daughter's schools were ranked in the bottom 2% in the nation, found this out over 10 years ago, due to industrial heavy metals in my Northwest Portland neighborhood. In the last 2 years, I've been among the 24-member team of public health advocates, industry reps, and local governments who have spent hundreds of hours, and frankly, almost as many hours outside of committee meetings and writing public comments to submit to DEQ as input to their current draft Cleaner Air Oregon rules. As Director Whitman mentioned, these will be finalized and presented to EQC in July 2018. Not a small component of the rulemaking process and the concentration of discussion was around what we call the risk action levels, or the RALs. These are the levels at which the public health risk of emissions would trigger a requirement for additional pollution controls. This is the crux of a health-based air program. It's key to prioritizing the highest levels of pollution as well as the communities most at risk. It is also the most complicated. The funding proposal in front of you is critical to ensure that the agency has the expertise to do this highly detailed risk analysis and can move beyond rubber stamping permits that maintain the status quo and haven't forced industry modernization in over 20 years. This is important to restore community trust and faith in regulators' ability to keep our families safe. And I really appreciate your support for this important funding package. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Alan Sprott. I'm Vice President of Environmental Affairs for Vigor. We operate a shipyard in Portland as well as in Washington State and Alaska. We are a Title V facility holding one of the larger air permits, and we're located right in the heart of an industrial area. We've looked at the Cleaner Air Oregon rules and run our facility through them on a preliminary basis, and we fully expect that we are going to have to make changes to our operations to accommodate the rules. They're not significant changes, but changes nonetheless, and we're happy to do that. We believe that DEQ to operate this program needs to be adequately funded to stand it up robustly. And equally important, we believe that the communities, the public at large, needs to have confidence in the program. Without that confidence, then the last 2 years of work is really has just been wasted. From our perspective, too, we're concerned that if it's not stood up appropriately, then certain regions of the state are going to take it upon themselves. And that means the city of Portland or Metro or Multnomah County is going to stand up its own program. We think it would be very bad for business if we have this balkanization of air quality program throughout the state because you don't have the resources to do it, or a state's just not big enough. We won't have the technical expertise within the agencies to do it. We won't have the guidance, and we won't have the funding. Thank you.
Probably have time for one or two questions. Representative Brocksmith.
Thank you. And it's good to see you again.
Good to see you.
So I wanted to talk about, ask you about wildfire and wildfire smoke. Where my understanding is we're learning a lot more about how harmful, because of the particulates, wildfire smoke is. And so my question is are you familiar with wildfire smoke, and how does it affect our lungs?
Thank you for asking, Representative and Representative Helm. So all of this is the same conversation, and I think that's one thing that's been really interesting is tobacco smoke, smoke from fires, smoke from burning chemicals, smoke from particulate matter. The issue are toxins and particulates. We don't want things lit on fire or heated up and breathed into the lungs. And I think there's a huge problem with pretending that they're all separate issues and not having a multi-pronged approach to address all of them. I would say that I volunteered in the fire shelters in the summer. I'm part of the Medical Reserve Corps in my community, and I have seen people's lung disease get absolutely worse. I had a lady who couldn't breathe. She couldn't get her inhalers because she'd lost them, and we were doing everything we could to try to get something for her. I would say that you have that every day when you have poor air quality and you have elevated levels of particulate matter in the air in your city. We know that it's very analogous to diesel exhaust and all of those things, and I think the way we do it is we do a robust air quality monitoring system to figure out and I'm a doctor. You diagnose the problem before you prescribe a solution. And I think there's a lot of where people kind of have their agenda a little bit and they want to focus on one problem and not the other problem, and it's all the same problem. And we will have resources and money to deal with the problems if we can diagnose it correctly and if we price the cost of human health when we think of all these things. A lot of times we talk about the cost of business, and I'm really sensitive to that because everyone's got to make a job. But the cost of business has to include the cost of devastating people's health. And so I think we bring all that together, and we have the resources to try to address, providing medications and providing assistance with forest fires and hopefully mitigating forest fires. But I would say that it's not a separate conversation, the particulate matter and the smoke. It's the same conversation. I think we need to have a robust way to monitor air quality. I would say if we know we're doing something intentionally, it's very different than if something's just happening to us. So knowingly putting something out into the air is something that we have control over. It's harder to control forest fires, but they're all a problem.
Thank you so much.
I'm going to thank this panel. Thank you very much for being here today. We appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
I'll invite up at this time Jay Dugsky. Jay?
Douglas.
Sorry, Jay. Jen Coleman and Carla Axman. Whoever's ready first. Jay, you want to start?
I'll get us started. Good afternoon, Chair Helm, Vice Chairs Power and Reschke, and members of the committee. I'm Dr. Jay Douglas. I'm the Environmental Health Director for Multnomah County. I really appreciate the opportunity to testify before you today in strong support for Hospital 4002. The Department of Environmental Quality regulatory overhaul, dubbed by Governor Brown, Cleaner Air Oregon, came in the wake of revelations of heavy metal emissions associated with uncontrolled industrial processes in neighborhoods of Southeast, Northeast, and North Portland. This happened because Oregon abides by minimum federal air quality standards designed to be protective of an entire airshed and do not account for individual characteristics, such as how close people are to a source. Over the last 18 months, DEQ and the Oregon Health Authority conducted an extensive process to address Oregon's permitting system, first by assembling a technical advisory group comprised of experts in air quality programs across the nation. The group identified the tools needed and available to fix the shortcomings that allow for excessive industrial pollutant concentrations in many areas of our state. DEQ and OHA then assembled a Rules Advisory Committee, a group made up of a diverse representation of stakeholders, including large and small businesses, industry advocates, local government, public interest groups, and environmental justice advocates. We participated in 9 full-day work sessions held from June 2016 to August 2017. RAC members, their associates, and members of the public committed, Mary said hundreds, I think it's thousands of hours in preparing for and participating in the meetings, and then preparing written comments aimed at enumerating and improving highly technical and complex materials associated with science, the science of toxicity, and the process of air permitting. Dr. Paul Lewis is the health officer from Multnomah County, Clackamas Counties, and Washington Counties. He served as a RAC member, and I served as his alternate. Paul and I both experienced the RAC as a place where many different voices and perspectives were heard and respected. It was here that DEQ and OHA spent many hours both educating the committee about the complex world of industrial air regulation, the permitting process, risk assessment, and the range of options that have been implemented around the nation to best protect public health, while supporting strong economic growth through industrial manufacturing. It was here that the committee reviewed in scrupulous detail proposed changes to DEQ's rules for industrial permitting, and it was here that DEQ and OHA were held to their commitment to an open and transparent process that balanced the needs of industry and the needs of communities. After the RAC completed its work, DEQ and OHA held scores of public meetings and input sessions around the state, where countless individuals volunteered their time to weigh in on the process. Multnomah County wants to acknowledge DEQ and OHA for their role in the cleaner air rulemaking process. It was nothing short of an extraordinary and intentional effort to meaningfully engage a broad representation of the public. The Portland metropolitan area is home to many of the industries that would be regulated under the proposed Cleaner Air Oregon rules, which is in part the reason we as a county have committed significant staff, leadership, and contractor resources to addressing the air quality and regulatory gaps that were exposed in early 2016. Our elected leaders at the City of Portland and Multnomah County have endorsed this commitment to resources to address industrial pollution concerns and are very eager to see DEQ supported in carrying out the reforms promised by Cleaner Air Oregon. We at the county are also quite aware that the conditions that gave rise to the situation that necessitated Cleaner Air Oregon are still operating. So the city and the county co-commissioned a study to explore the options available to local jurisdictions to address pollution created in local jurisdictions and airsheds. The results of that investigation are expected at the end of this month, but one area that we have considered seriously is the option of creating a local air authority should DEQ be unable to carry out its mission. Senate House Bill 4002 allows for the assessment of reasonable fees on industrial emitters that will allow for the implementation of Cleaner Air Oregon. The request is reasonable, and the resources are essential in honoring the commitment that the governor made to the people of Oregon. We encourage you in the strongest terms possible to support this important legislation. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Let's finish up this panel.
Chair Helm, Vice Chairs, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity. My name is Jennifer Coleman. I represent Oregon Environmental Council. Our board, our staff, and our members all urge strong support for this bill. As an organization that works at the nexus of human health and the environment, we support a regulatory program for toxic air emissions based on human health standards. And we know that establishing a fee to implement such a program is an investment that, based on all precedent, will deliver health, environmental, and economic benefits to Oregon. We can see from air quality programs established by federal authorities and delegating authority to states, they have delivered benefits that at the most conservative estimates have delivered 3-to-1 on their costs. We also know that it is an EPA priority for the 21st century to be looking at industrial sources of air toxics, and that the US EPA has determined that state authorities are best equipped to regulate such toxics. We know that in order for such a program to succeed, it needs to be funded in a way that we can count on that funding. If we're going to have a robust, efficient, and predictable regulatory program, we need to fund that with fees from reasonable fees from industry. After being subject to budget declines and hiring freezes, Oregon's air quality program has been operating short of staff and resources necessary to succeed. The recent state audit concluded that DEQ permit writers carry a far heavier workload than other state agencies. We believe that we can no longer ignore toxic emissions that have the potential to cause irreversible lifelong harm, and that less medical expenses and greater productivity at work at school will pay off for Oregon's economy and way of life if we regulate these toxic air emissions. Thank you.
Carla?
I'm Carla Axman. I'm representing the Audubon Society of Portland, and I'm going to read our testimony into the record. When reports surfaced in 2016 that high concentrations of industrial heavy metals were found in moss samples in Portland, local residents mobilized quickly to address the public risk. Governor Brown responded with the Cleaner Air Oregon initiative, which required Oregon DEQ and Oregon Health Authority to work together to establish health-based standards for air permits. For the last 2 years, stakeholders have devoted hundreds of hours to meetings and submitted hundreds of pages of comments. Last fall, Oregon DEQ and Oregon Health Authority released a draft of the Cleaner Air Oregon rules, which are expected to be finalized and presented to the Environmental Quality Commission in July of 2018. While advocates still believe the rules don't go far enough to establish enforceable limits on dangerous pollutants, consensus was reached that the new Cleaner Air Oregon program would be a huge step forward. The program will allow us to better assess risk and provide greater oversight for cleaning up the most dangerous pollution in Oregon. The new rules emphasize common sense risk evaluations based on the amount of human exposure and the potential toxicity of each pollutant. HB 4002 will provide critical funding for DEQ's new Cleaner Air Oregon Air Permit Program, given the Oregon Secretary of State's recently released audit concluding the agency was failing to protect the public due to chronic underfunding by the state legislature. It's vital our elected leaders put the agency back on track. The Audubon Society of Portland supports this bill, and we are looking forward to continuing discussions on protecting our environment and the health of our communities. Thank you.
Thank you all. I think I'm going to move on to the next panel. We appreciate your testimony today very much.
Thank you.
At this time, I'm going to invite Mike Friess and Heath Curtis up. I see Mike.
Yeah.
Maybe Heath is outside. We can get, how about we get going with you, Mike, and we'll find him. You don't need to keep carrying his water all the time.
All
Thank you, Chair Helm, members of the committee. For the record, Mike Fries, and I'm here on behalf of Oregonians for Fair Air Regulation. We're a coalition of a number of members and trade associations representing about, I think, 1,700 businesses and about 250,000 employees. This has been, as others that have provided testimony, this has been kind of a rulemaking unlike anything I've ever experienced in Oregon. DEQ did a pretty fantastic job of trying to, on such a complex issue, bring different Rules Advisory Committee members, including myself, up to speed on air toxics regulation and how it works and how EPA does it, how other states regulate air toxics. And through, you know, a fairly lengthy process, DEQ came out with a proposed rule. During the processes, we provided multiple documents to the agency and comments in the RAC, the Rules Advisory Committee. And ultimately, we were really troubled by the direction that the agency was headed. And some of that testimony you heard last session when this very issue came up before the legislature, and the legislature ultimately decided not to fund the program or setting up the program. And we're here for the very same reasons as we were last session. And we had thought that we could work out a something that worked better for businesses in Oregon, for all of Oregon, but unfortunately, we didn't get there. We have been working on a compromise because we recognize that Oregon needs an air toxic program that works. Communities need they need to have confidence in an agency that is built to protect them and to ensure that Oregon can operate clean businesses. And so with that in mind, we have been working in, on the Senate side to see if we can find a path forward this session. I think this session it's really important for us to find resolution around this issue. And I'd like to think that we're really close. We will be testifying in the matter of minutes on the Senate side on a -1 amendment to Senate Bill 1541. That is that will change probably again. There will be another dash amendment to that bill, but we hope that we have something that we can pass out of committee on Wednesday. And ultimately, it will go into Joint Ways and Means Committee to make sure that their proper fees are put in place to carry out and implement this program. I would say that businesses and employees engaged in this rulemaking process, I believe about 75%. Director Whitman mentioned the postcards. Those were from employees. They weren't from businesses. Probably about 75% or roughly 75% of the comments that the agency received on their proposed rule were opposed to the rule for the very reasons that businesses has described. I'll submit written testimony as well that goes through some of the particulars and also explains a little bit about Senate Bill 1541. We'd be happy to come and talk to you more about what we're working on the Senate side and make sure that you're all comfortable so that when it comes over here, we can have final resolution over this issue. So with that, I'll stand for questions.
Very good. Heath, go right ahead.
Chair Helm, members of the committee, my name is Heath Curtis, and I'm here with the Oregon Forest Industries Council. For those of you who haven't met me before, OFIC is a trade association representing Oregon's large timber landowners and forest products manufacturers. Our membership is comprised of about 50 members that own or control about 6 million acres in Oregon, and employment in our sector in Oregon accounts for about 60,000 jobs. I'm here urging your no vote on House Bill 4002, given the setup that Mike gave you before. We're working diligently on compromise language on the Senate side. The DEQ rule and the program that Director Whitman described earlier are highly problematic for our industry. Notwithstanding the representations of the representative from Vigor Industries, this bill would have extraordinary consequences for wood products facilities. His comments are not at all representative of my membership's experience. And the solicitation for funding comes at the expense of my members. The regulatory thresholds in the program proposed by the agency are out of line from a perspective. They propose regulatory thresholds, and we can talk some about what these mean if you want to, but at excess lifetime cancer risk of 25 in a million and a hazard index of 1. LA, Los Angeles, the South Coast Air Quality Management District, is one of the most rigorous programs in the nation and has benchmarks at 25 in a million and a hazard index of 3. Now, I would object if they wanted to overlay the LA program over the entire state, but it would in fact be less rigorous than what they have proposed in their rule at 25 and 1. Most of the California rural jurisdictions regulate at an excess lifetime cancer risk of 100 and a hazard index of 10. Now, these are all very technical arguments, but attributes of the rule, but it's a very technical rule. So with regard to those risk thresholds, you heard earlier testimony that there was thousands of hours poured into efforts around where this rule should land. I participated in those thousands of hours, and I assure you that I have many hundreds of my own. But that rule advisory committee, they never voted on that number. There was no vote by the agency. This is a proposed number that they floated for public comment even prior before it goes to the Environmental Quality Commission. So what is a risk level? When you set a risk program and you decide an activity is too risky, how do you do that, right? You can assess what may be the impacts to a particular population in terms of health impacts. You could assess what could be the economic impacts to businesses in Oregon. There are a number of different elements that you can analyze, but none of those actually give you the answer. That is to say, what we deem as a society is too risky isn't a thing that's dictated by science or economics. That's a policy question. And I'm here to tell you, given the impacts to our business relative to the very low likelihood of impacts to communities, we think they made the wrong policy choice in the numbers that they proposed. And that's why we've come to the legislature to ask for some guidance around what we as a community feel is the right level of risk for the community. So, finally, I would say I should end on this. My members have wood products facilities spread across rural Oregon. In many towns, this is the only business in town with good paying jobs, with health insurance, paying for kids to go to college. And I want to assure you that poverty is a primary determinant of health. That is to say, imposing major costs on these businesses at potentially the expense of those businesses can be much more likely in terms of health impacts than the nominal impacts we're talking about in terms of excess lifetime cancer risk or non-cancer risks that are proposed in this program. So please, please be very sober about your approach to this. And we would urge your no vote on this funding bill pending resolution on the Senate bill.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Curtis or Mr. Fries? Representative Power.
Thank you. Mike, I'm glad to hear you say that your comments were reassuring to me. I'm glancing through the Dash 1 amendment to that bill that was posted just today, and I'm a little concerned. It appears to turn Clean Air Oregon into a pilot program to be based upon who has the highest cancer risk currently. Am I misunderstanding that? And is that something, and if not, is that something that's going to continue moving forward and geographically shrinking the application of this rulemaking process?
So thank you for the question, Representative Power, Chair Helm. Yes, so you are misunderstanding. So that is in addition to a statewide program. So we'd still have a statewide program. The framework is very similar to what was established by the proposed rule. But what it does is it sets aside a pilot program in probably, I mean, it would be up to DEQ where that pilot program occurs in counties over 500,000 that would say if you are in, it would draw a map based on a number of conditions, and if you're in within that area, then if you want to increase risk, then you have to offset that risk either at your facility, and if you can at your facility, then you would pay into a fund that would offset that direct risk. And
Chair Helm, Representative Power, if I may, that's a provocative element of Senate Bill 1541 and the Dash 1 amendments. I think it's worth noting that no other program in the nation regulates risk at one facility on the basis of another facility's emissions in this manner. What Cleaner Air Oregon has proposed is setting risk thresholds for an individual facility and regulating the facility to those risk thresholds. What this pilot program would do is then spread that out and say, okay, if we have more than one facility that are contributing to risk at a particular location and they want to grow, then they're obligated to offset that risk. We're going to see how that works. It's never been tried before, and I think it's an interesting concept, but that is included as a component of the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 1541.
Representative Brocksmith.
Thank you. And thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony. And Heath, you mentioned earlier that that some of our business community in the industry could be severely impacted. And I know that one of the last, well, the only remaining mill in Curry County and their lamb facility is very concerned about Cleaner Air Oregon and being able to, because it was, as it was testified before, some of these facilities have been there for a long time, and you know, as a former city councilor and county commissioner, they allowed these residential properties to build up around them, and it shouldn't have happened. Maybe. So, when it comes to this, I mean, that's a significant. There's about 450 jobs in the Brookings Harbor region down there that could be impacted by this. And if you reflect those to the urban region, it's, you know, what are they, times it by 10 or 100? I can't remember. But my question is what is the impact in jobs? And I'm asking you to come up with a number. If these facilities or industries across the state were unable to meet the requirements, as we heard before, that DEQ is going to help them meet, what's the impact across the state, or more particularly in rural Oregon?
So that's, Chair Helm, Representative Brock-Smith, that's tough math. I can approach it in a couple ways. One, the agency appeared before you, I believe, and while I didn't catch all of the testimony from the other hearing room, and represented that, you know, there are mechanisms for compliance that don't require shutting the business down. And what that mostly involves is assessing a business's ability to pay for pollution control technologies. And I'm here to tell you that extracting all of the profit out of a business is the same effectively as shutting it down. That is to say, you remove the incentive to keep running it. So with that understanding, I can also tell you that our members have been analyzing the impacts on their own businesses, and they are highly consequential. That is to say, the cost and the expenditures to comply with this rule are very, very high. We took a shot at this. We don't have excellent information about every industrial sector in Oregon. We don't have excellent information about their emissions. And frankly, we think that that's a thing that the agency should double down on and find more about. But we did commission a study by Mal Foster that used the agency's own information to try and assess what the economic impact to Oregon businesses would be in terms of net present value over the duration of the program. And Mike, remind me if I'm wrong, but it's like $2 billion worth of impact to Oregon industry. And so we think that's pretty consequential. And there are places where you could invest that kind of, you can make much smaller investments and realize much larger returns on health. I might also offer that toxics don't disperse generally very far. And when you're talking about a risk of 100 in a million, that may be an increased risk of 100 in a million to only 10 people, right? It's not like 100 people are going to contract cancer. In fact, the overwhelming odds at 100 in a million, the overwhelming odds is that nobody will contract cancer at that risk in that small a population size.
Well, just a quick follow-up.
One Mike. Quick, and then we got
more
three more
comment
people.
Than a question, really. But we had DEQ in an earlier energy and environment meeting. We talked about wildfires earlier, and it's concerning when I'm in dealing with the Chetco bar fire and the smoke that was so thick that you couldn't see 100 feet ahead of you, and to hear that wildfires are irrelevant to various issues in different sectors. So,
Chair, Representative Brock Smith, I agree, and maybe one way to tackle that is to say, if we're going to make investments in reducing health risk for people, what's the best bang for the buck? Where's the cheapest place to go get those health risk reductions? And I suggest that wildfire would be a really good one. Stationary industrial sources comprising about 15% of pollution in Oregon is maybe the very most expensive place you could go realize those risk reductions.
Thank you.
Thank you both for being here today. We appreciate you being here. I'm going to end. This is the final panel. Ephraim Payne, Tori Cole, and Catherine Saltzman.
I have to start because I'm going to be quick.
Well, we can do that.
Chair Helm, members of the committee, thank you for having us here to talk about this important bill. My name is Catherine Salzman. I'm a member of the Eastside Portland Air Coalition, and I'm here today on behalf of our 3,700 members and also a coalition of 30 neighborhood associations and organizations from around the state. Eastside Portland Air Coalition started around the Bullseye Glass thing, but we've expanded our interests, obviously, because we've been involved with Cleaner Oregon. We had a seat on the committee, on the Rules Advisory Committee, and also attended all the technical work group meetings. My comments that I wrote repeat everything that the people who preceded me say, so I'm not going to repeat those. I will just mail them into your exhibits, and you can have our formal comments that way. But I want to, can I come up there? I want to hand out this.
If you have enough copies.
Yeah, I have five, but these are available online on the Cleaner Air Oregon website. And it's a pyramid that you've probably already seen it, but I'd like you to have it while you're doing your work session on this bill, because some of the things that Heath Curtis said are misleading. You're not locked into the 25 and a million. The DEQ has, and the OHA have gone out of their way to accommodate the needs of...
If you sit back a little bit.
Oh, sorry. I'm sorry. I'm not mic savvy. I've really got. If you look at that, you'll see one side is existing facilities, how the program works for existing facilities, and the other side is how it works for new facilities. Obviously, air quality advocates think that there shouldn't be two separate columns. That to be truly protective of public health, you would be operating in the category with new facilities. Everybody would be doing that. However, the DEQ and OHA, in order to be practical and to accommodate the needs of business, they have created this graduated scale. The health, you'll see that there's, even with the health index, he was saying that we were locked into the health index of one. This is not true. OHA has worked out a protocol, because obviously different chemicals have different non-cancer effects. So that has some flex in it that's built into the system, as well as this graduated system all the way up to 500 cancers in a million.
Thank you for bringing that.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Hi, Chair Helm, representatives. My name is Tori Cole. I am an environmental attorney. I graduated from Lewis and Clark in 2015, and air has been my focus. I'm also a staff member at Neighbors for Clean Air, but today I'm actually testifying specifically on behalf of residents of the Lentz neighborhood, who we've been organizing in conjunction with our partners at Green Lentz, which is a tiny nonprofit. So. Lentz residents couldn't be here today, but they're going to be in the building tomorrow to speak to their individual legislators. But we all hope that you'll support HB 4002. Lentz is a diverse outer southeast Portland neighborhood that suffers disproportionately from diesel and small-scale industrial emissions. When I say small-scale, I don't necessarily mean the emissions are small-scale, but that the actual business is a smaller one. Like many other communities we've organized within the past year working on Cleaner Air Oregon, Lentz residents have had a really hard time comprehending why health-based air quality rules weren't already in place in Oregon. A lot of them ask me, well, why would it be legal if it could make us sick? In particular, I met with a group of Spanish-speaking mothers who painstakingly mapped out their children's walking routes to school, pointing out each source of emissions they pass along the way and why each one poses a concern to these mothers. Many of these sources are actually identified in DEQ's recent audits as sources that lacked proper permitting for 7 years or more, specifically of VOC's emissions, due to lack of staffing and resources at DEQ. If you want more information about that, you can look at pages 17 and 18 of the audit. And yeah, that's due to failure to implement basic air contaminant discharge permits for surface coaters that emit hazardous air pollutants. And I'll submit that into the record written as well. Lentz and other communities like these have done phenomenal work to educate themselves in the absence of effective pollution controls. I'm particularly shocked that people who don't even speak English were able to point out to me every place that they're worried about based on what they're emitting. Residents shouldn't have to work this hard to try and avoid unhealthy air. Oregonians deserve better, especially children who absorb more toxins from the air than adults. Please ensure the Cleaner Air Oregon program gets funded, and let this be the first step in adequately funding the agency's tasks with protecting our communities and natural resources. Thank you so much.
So, thank you, Chairman Hellman, members of the committee, for allowing us to speak. My name is Ephraim Payne, and I'm a staff member of Beyond Toxics. We are a statewide environmental justice organization. I urge members of this committee to support HB 4002 to get Oregon to where it needs to be in terms of air quality. The Cleaner Air Oregon program has been through a multi-year consulting process with a diverse and balanced technical and policy advisory groups, as you've heard. Months of study and recommendations have gone into the proposed rules. The Cleaner Air Oregon proposed rules strike a smart balance between the needs of the public and industry. The policy is ready. It has been vetted over and over again. Please, let's not delay. HB 4002 provides the funding and the strategy to protect our air quality. I'd like to talk for a minute about the fiscal impacts of Cleaner Air Oregon. The DEQ proposes to address up to 80 facilities within the first 5 years out of approximately 2,563 known permitted facilities potentially subject to the rules. This tiered implementation program is important. It will delay fiscal impacts for many businesses, providing longer lead times and a period of analysis and compliance planning so folks can get up to speed. This approach will allow facilities to better plan for compliance and to achieve that compliance at less cost. The proposed rules are intended to establish a focused and consistent approach to regulating toxins. Based on improved understanding of just how dangerous it is to breathe air toxics, coupled with increased financial efficiencies and effectiveness of emission control equipment, it is inevitable that polluting sources will be required to achieve industrial emissions reductions in the near future. We've heard that already. We've also heard that more than 30 states have already done this. They've already implemented health-based air pollution control regulations, and I thank the committee for supporting the same protection for Oregon and our citizens.
Thank you very much for being here. We appreciate your testimony, and we'll look for those submissions as well.
Yes, and I'll submit that pyramid thing too, so everybody can have a copy.
Thank you. We appreciate it. Okay. Representative Power.
Colleagues, I just wanted to make a quick statement to you on the issue, particularly because we know that the primary negotiations are happening in the Senate side on this. And I think for those of you who are new, you don't know that this is my district that was predominantly affected by Bullseye and precision cast parts. We have to finish this session. I would not wish any of you the angst that I have had to witness with my constituents as they wait for the state to take action on this. From my days on city council when the issue first came up, I've had parents and moms sitting, testifying before me at all levels of government, asking us to please implement a program where they can be confident that their kids can eat the vegetables from their backyard gardens. I understand that our business advocates and others within the environmental field have not seen eye to eye, but it would be, I think, in my estimation, a dereliction of our duty in helping to oversee public health through safe and prudent legislation to let this go again this year. So please, please do give it consideration. Thank you.
Okay. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 4002. And I'm carrying House Bill 4002 over to our Wednesday, February 14th agenda. Also, before we move to the next bill, I am going to carry over House Bill 4148 to our agenda on Wednesday, February 14th as well. And thank you, our friends from the Department of Energy that came just in case today. But we will be taking that up in full on Wednesday. At this time, I am opening a public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 4022. And I'll invite Representative Barnhart. Representative Barnhart, would you like our representatives from DAS and the governor's office with you? Okay.
Yeah.
And I'll invite Lindsay Baker and Ruchi Sadir up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Phil Barnhart. I'm the state representative from House District 11. And as the members of the committee are probably aware, I have been working on the issue of how we get electric vehicles charged for the last several years. Electric vehicles, as I'm sure all of the committee and the members know, I've been saying it often enough, are the best vehicles available of any kind in the United States. They accelerate better, they're more comfortable, they're quieter, they're cheaper to operate, and better in every single way than a gasoline-powered car, except one way. And that way is that they take longer to fuel. So when you are working on the issue of how we're going to make the transition from fossil fuel powered vehicles to electric vehicles, you have to consider seriously the issue of fueling cars. We've dealt, and rather than repeat it all, because I know that our time is limited today, I'll simply note that I've promoted and the legislature has passed a number of bills that encourage the installation of electric vehicle charging. Those bills, I'm happy to report, have been working well. One of the bills that has come up in the not terribly long past, that was adopted, that is the one that this bill 4022 is intended to amend. The law that we have now allows DAS and other agencies to install a very limited number of electric vehicle chargers at state facilities. This bill would amend that to allow them to make determinations that they could install them at many locations that are sufficient to meet demand for the devices or facilities, and that the department will establish criteria by means of which a state agency will determine an appropriate number of locations at which the state agency may install or have installed devices or facilities described. So it essentially removes this very small limitation, which I think was put in place because we were trying to work on a pilot project. We are at the stage now where the state is considering buying electric vehicles as part of the fleet. They're going to need electric chargers at a variety of locations around the state to charge their own cars at night. Doing it correctly would mean that those chargers would be available for state employees or visitors to charge their cars during the daytime when the state cars are out. And this bill is part of that process. I would also note that the original law was either ambiguous or just wrong about the process of how we pay for electric vehicle charging. In in the way that law was written, it was intended, or at least it appeared to say, that the entire cost of installing electric vehicle charging ought to be paid, borne by the person who charges. And what that means is that we'd be talking about land costs, we'd be talking about the installation of charging equipment, in addition to the cost of electricity administration, maintenance, and the ongoing cost of operation. Well, I think it should be clear to anybody who's actually looked at this kind of issue, the effect of having that kind of a requirement essentially means that there won't be any electric vehicle chargers, or at least very few, that could meet that criteria in a way that would allow an economical charge to be placed. So instead of that, what this bill has proposed, and these are not my ideas, they come from the Department of Administrative Services, who's been working on this now for a couple of years, I think. Instead of doing that, they would allow for what's on the second page of the bill, lines 13 through about 21. Basically, it would allow them to charge to the maximum extent practicable the cost of operating and administering the devices or facilities, and it would also say that these charges would not exceed 110% of the average market price for delivering electricity to the public for the purpose of charging electric vehicles in the county in which the device or facility is located. So the idea is that they would set the price in that way. Now, if it is the legislature's intent, and I think it is, to make this transition from the standard internal combustion engine vehicle to electric vehicles, which have all of the attributes that I've already described and a whole lot more that you know better than I do, this kind of an approach is needed. DAS believes they can administer, and I should let them speak for themselves, this program set up this way, and I would commend the bill to the committee's attention and hope that it can be sent onto the floor with a due pass.
Great. Thank you, Representative Barnhart.
Good afternoon, Chair Helm, Vice Chair Reschke, Vice Chair Power, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ruchi Sudhir. I'm Governor Kate Brown's Energy and Climate Change Policy Advisor. I wanted to share some information about what I've been seeing with regard to EVs. In Oregon, we're seeing overall an increase of EVs, about 30 to 40% each year. Before coming here, I checked with the DMV, and at the end of 2015, there were 8,700 EVs registered in the state of Oregon. At the end of 2016, there were 12,500 registered in Oregon, and at the end of 2017, 16,000. So you're seeing a progressive increase over time. And I think that's due to a number of reasons that Representative Barnhart just mentioned in terms of the sort of newer vehicles that are coming about. But we also have a number of policies in Oregon that put the state on a path towards greater transportation electrification. So last session we saw an EV rebate, and previously we saw an investor-owned utility transportation electrification and investment plans coming about. So with these policies in place in Oregon, we expect to see even more over time. And if you spend time perusing trade journals, which I don't expect or recommend for you to do, you'll note and a kind of unfortunate acronym in these trade journals, and it's RIP. And it's handy to remember RIP, but it's kind of sad to think about. But it's used in the discussion of barriers to transportation electrification and further adoption. The R stands for range, the I stands for infrastructure, and the P stands for price. So all the people out there that think about electrification of the transportation sector think about what kinds of policies or things that we can do in those three categories. And we see car manufacturers looking at range quite a bit and price, and you see new cars coming into the market that have greater ability to go further distances on one charge, and you see price points coming down. This bill is dealing with the I in the IRP, which is infrastructure. And the bill makes some modest changes to statute that would allow state agencies to keep up with what we're seeing in the non-state parking facilities around the state, while continuing to recover costs for investments and relying on the private sector through contracts for installing EV chargers. I'm going to pass it to Lindsay here for any additional details. Thank you.
Thanks, Richie. So Chair Helm, Representative, Chair Helm, members of the committee, for the record, Lindsay Baker with the Department of Administrative Services. I'm not sure that I have too much to add based off of what you've already heard so far in the conversations that we have all had with you individually. If I might just add a finer point on what this measure really intends to do. So first, you already heard about eliminating the statutory cap on number of locations an agency can install per biennium. But the second piece of the measure, which is perhaps the maybe more important piece of the measure, is really just giving agencies the flexibility to establish uniform rates for what that consumer end price of the electric charging is. So right now we have found that across the different stations that we, DAS, have installed, have really contracted out through the private sector to install stations, that the price has really fluctuated depending on a lot of different factors, right? The value of the land, the degree to which we have to upgrade the existing electrical infrastructure, the degree to which we have to install new, dig new trenches, install new concrete pads, that sort of thing. So if we are in a position right now where we have to recover 100% of the cost that's location specific, the end consumer price really fluctuates and is oftentimes so much higher above the market rate that it actually disincentivizes the use of those stations. So what we are trying to do here is really just have the flexibility to make those, to make that calculation and that method of determining the price consistent across stations that the state operates. Other than that, I'm not sure I have anything else to add, but happy to answer any questions if there are any.
Committee. Representative Marsh, and then Reschke, and then Brocksmith.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Helm. So we've talked about these as using the word install, using the word contracting. Can one of you just go through specifically how this works and what piece of it the state takes on and what piece of it the state hands off to someone else?
Sure. Representative Helm, Chair Helm, Representative Marsh. So the way that I understand the way that that this process works in practically speaking, is that this state agency would sort of determine, we think that based off of requests that we've had, based off of increase in demand, we believe that XYZ location would be suitable to have an electric vehicle charging station. So we would put out, whether that would be an RFP or whatever that sort of solicitation document would look like, we would put out a call to the private market to say, hey, we want to install this station here. Can you please respond with bids or proposals on what might be suitable? And then we would just go through what is typically a sort of public contracting or procurement process to negotiate what that price would look like, what the timeline would look like, and sort of how that ownership model would function. I've got a sort of our technical folks in the back, so looks like I indeed described it correctly.
Up. Thank you.
Yeah.
Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Rep. Barnhart, for this bill. And a couple of questions I have is there currently is a cap on DAS on how many charging stations you can install per year right now. This bill would remove that. Does that cap also apply to private enterprise? So if PGE wanted to put in or Washington Square, or does it apply to other entities outside of DAS?
Chair Helm, Representative Reschke, my understanding is that no, it does not. The existing statutory cap only applies to state agencies that want to make the installation.
Thank you. Follow-up?
Follow-up.
What does it cost on average to install a charging station? I know you said it varies widely, but
right.
If you had an average price, are we talking $5, $50, $5,000, $50,000? What's
sure.
The cost?
Chair Helm, Representative Reschke. So the average, and again, I really do want to emphasize the fact that the low number of the range and the high number of the range are really far apart. That said, the average is about $7,000.
Okay, and then a follow-up? How long does it take to with this bill? How long will it take to recover the cost of that? Because from my understanding, DAS will install or contract the installation, pay the $7,000 on average. Mm-hmm. Then they're going to make that up by recovering that through the charging. How long would that take?
Chair Helm, Representative Rushkey. So the way that we do our, the method of calculation that we use right now is based on a 20-year period of cost recovery.
20 years. Okay. That seems like a long time. What I'm thinking is that how many stations does DAS have that kind of, because I looked, the fiscal seems to be minimal, so I'm wondering where the money's coming from to build $7,000 stations and then take 20 years to recover the initial outlay.
I might see if our program manager can come up and answer some of these more technical questions, if that's all right with the chair.
Yep, please.
While he's coming up, I'll jump in with one thing, yeah. Which is that one of the flexibility pieces here that's helpful is that when they have the flexibility to see where there's demand, there's greater likelihood of user usage, and that way you're potentially recovering faster.
Right.
Chair Helm, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brian King. I'm the Fleet and Parking Manager for the Department of Administrative Services. Representative Rusky, for the answer to your question, why it's minimal right now is because the way the fiscal impact statements ask is this an added cost to the budget from what you have?
Yeah.
We already have budgeted in our capital projects fund to do improvements on the parking structures and the lots. So part of that is installing EV infrastructure. So the cost on the fiscal is minimal because we already have it budgeted for that.
Understood.
Representative Brock-Smith.
Questions were already asked and answered. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions of this panel? Okay. Thank you all very much.
Yeah, thank you.
And then,
Mr. Chair, I have one more comment, two more comments, if I may. One is on the last question, and then one is to introduce the reason why LC is here.
And are you going to invite LC up?
Yes, please.
Thank you. He has a name.
Thank you. That's Mr. Chair, that's very helpful. When you're about to repave a parking lot, is the time to put in the conduit underground. That's the time when your costs are minimal because you're tearing it up anyway. And so it's sort of an add-on to the last comment. When you're doing repairs, when you're making changes, that's the time to do this work to get it in place when the costs are low because you're going to put asphalt down or a new layer of concrete or something anyway. I wanted to bring legislative counsel in today because we got a question from the municipal electrical utilities about this bill, wondering if this bill was going to have an effect on their rate-making authority or their conditions of operation authority in the operation of the municipal utilities. I have to tell you, it never occurred to me that this bill had anything to do with that. I think LC is going to agree with me that it doesn't have anything to do with those things. We attempted to draft an amendment, and it's very difficult to draft an amendment to say this bill doesn't have anything to do with a particular topic. And so the amendment doesn't come out saying very much. I will not propose, Mr. Chair, that the amendment be moved. But I did bring LC in because I think to deal with the question that I just raised, because I think it deals with the potential of opposition to the bill, which I think goes away if the municipal electric utilities are assured that this bill does not affect their authority or operations.
Chair Helm, members of the committee, Sean Brennan, Legislative Council. What Representative Barnhart says is true. The bill is really focused entirely on what state agencies are able to do in order to construct these electrical vehicle charging stations. It really has nothing to do with rate making in the sense that the utilities themselves would be impacted by that and their rate making. It does go into letting the state agencies under the guidance of DAS make certain rate setting for the actual electricity that's delivered at the charging station. And I think the concern of the utilities was that there are contracts that they might have with some of their utility suppliers, such as BPA and others, that set a cap on resale of electricity. And in that sense, their concerns were, we discussed them with a couple of people down in Springfield in particular.
And although I was not entirely convinced that that was going to be a concern that they would have to worry about in this particular case, because again, the bill is directed toward what the utility, the state agencies or their contractors can do, we did draft the amendment with the hope of really restricting the scope of the bill only to those instances where there are utility service provisions in contracts from BPA or other investor or community-owned utilities that could set a cap on resale of electricity. And for that reason, that amendment does exist. But again, it's up to the committee at this point whether they want to move forward with that, given that there is some concern from the utilities on that score. Again, my personal judgment on this is that I don't think it really would have much of an impact, because we're talking about a contract that may be two contracts away from the one that would actually set a cap on resale of electricity. So if, for example, BPA set a cap on resale of electricity from a state agency that contracts with another vendor, say Blink, which does the ones that back here on State Street, it's hard to see where the contract language that would fit in from BPA to the secondary utility would then follow through to Blink or to the state agency itself. But if that is actually something that can be demonstrated or shown in the contracts themselves, then I think the amendment that was proposed would take care of that.
Any questions, committee, for Mr. Brennan? Okay. Thank you both for being here. I had Brian Krieg signed up, but I don't see him.
I'll take a look.
So I'm while Representative Barnhart is
he was looking for
Did you find him? Did you find him?
No.
Okay. I'm going to stand at ease, colleagues, so that our Republican colleagues can chat about. Okay, we're back on the record after a brief recess. We're still considering House Bill 4022. We were in a public hearing and work session, just completed testimony, and at this point I would entertain a motion to move this bill along.
Chair Helm, I move House Bill 4022 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Power moves House Bill 4022 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Vice Chair Risch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to be a reluctant yes. My reluctancy is it always drives the cost, and I understand the cost is baked in this year, but what about in future budgets? And I don't want us to go hog wild now that we've removed the cap. So that's, I will be a yes, but that's my concern.
Okay. Any other discussion? Okay. With that, would the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Barnhart.
Aye.
Representative Bonham.
Yes.
Representative Holvey.
Aye.
Representative Finley.
Aye.
Representative Marsh.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Vice Chair Reschke.
Aye.
Vice Chair Power.
Aye.
Chair Helm.
Aye. The motion passes. And where does this go? This floor will go directly to the House floor. Representative Barnhart, will you be the carrier?
Yes, thank you, sir.
Okay. And with that, I'll close the public hearing and work session on House Bill 4022. And folks, I had hoped to have our legal counsel, Maureen McGee, explain the Dash 3 amendment to House Bill 4001 today, but we are right up against our normal time, and she tells me that her prepared testimony and explanation of that amendment is going to take 10 to 15 minutes and likely need, in the Senate today, it took another 15 minutes for questions. So I just don't think we could jam it into our schedule today. So I'm going to hold that one over until Wednesday. So I will carry over the work session on House Bill 4001 to our agenda on Wednesday, February 14th.
4048.
We did that all right. And just in an abundance of caution, all of the bills not worked today will be carried over to Wednesday, February 14th, 2018. And with that, colleagues, thank you for being here, and I am adjourning the House Committee on Energy and Environment.
I like that abundance.